Thank you very much for the introduction, and I'm very pleased to be here in Toronto, where it's very nice summer. So I'm coming from Europe, where it's really cold. It's like 15 degrees, and it's almost snowing. So I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this interesting workshop. So we'll start out today with solid-state physics. So we actually treat quantum coherence in dirty metals, okay? And I will talk a bit about quantum coherence, or what we call quantum coherence, in metallic quantum wires and networks. So our system, well, that's a quantum system, are electrons. So these are electrons in a dirty metal. And this quantum system, well, which is a closed system, well, we couple this to the environment. If we want to do a transport measurement, we have to attach leads to it. So we can couple it to an environment, and the environment can be many things. Well, we can have this really macroscopic environment, which are our leads, but also we have phonons in our system. We have, well, of course, other electrons, so there will be also an interaction between electrons. We can have spins in there, two-leveled systems, and so on. And I will talk about two different environments during my talk. So one is actually what happens if you change simply the geometry of our conductor. So we will talk about small metallic conductors, which are of micrometric size. If you simply change the size, what happens to the quantum coherence? And in the second part of my talk, I will concentrate on what happens if you put a spin into our system, and how will this affect the quantum coherence. So metal, what we think the ground state of our metal is, or what we strongly believe, is basically a disordered metal. So in low dimension, is still a Fermi liquid. Okay. Doesn't this work?
Okay.
So it's still a Fermi liquid. And what we call the decoherence rate, or the dephasing rate, is basically the quasi-particle inelastic rate. So as the electron travels through the conductor, it bounces against many impurities. And when it hits an impurity where it loses, for instance, energy, then, of course, it will lose decoherence. And so we define 1 over tau phi, approximately. It's the inelastic scattering rate. Okay, so then, well, since this is a Fermi liquid, so we can argue that, well, we have the Fermi function, and we can say that if we want to scatter into a final state, of course, we need a phase space, and the phase space is basically proportional to kBT, so we can scatter into this phase space to the power of p, which depends on the effective dimension. And now the question is, when you go to zero temperature, what actually happens? So if we're in this framework, then, of course, we can say, well, the temperature goes to zero, so the phase coherence time should diverge, or the rate should go to zero, okay, as the phase space crunches to zero at zero temperature, okay? So what we strongly believe is that the phase coherence time of an electron in a metal goes to infinity at zero temperature, okay? And that was worked out in the 80s by Altshuler, Aronoff, and Kamnitsky, and they actually said they calculated for a quasi one-dimensional conductor, so that's what we will look at, so a quantum wire, that this rate, so the phase coherence rate, diverges as t to the power of 2/3. And that's due to the electron-electron interaction. Okay. So, well, that was the theory. And then about 10 years ago, there were very careful studies of the phase coherence time in quantum wires. So these are gold wires, so this was done by Raj Mohanty and Richard Webb. Actually, there's a third author, Jari Vala, which I forgot to put. Sorry for that. So these people studied very carefully the phase coherence time as a function of temperature. So at high temperature, you see that's the electron-phonon contribution. That's something which decreases very rapidly. But at low temperatures, this should diverge. This should go to infinity, and it does not. Okay. So the theory says, as I told you before, the phase coherence time should diverge with the power law, which depends on the effective dimension. And most of the experiments actually show that it saturates. It's not just in these wires. They showed other experiments at that time. And in most experiments, or basically in all experiments, this saturates. So a few years ago, another group, the Suckley-Michigan collaboration, they remeasured this on what they pretend cleaner wires, and they pretend that actually these wires don't saturate, and I will come back to this point later on, okay? So at that time, then, the saturation, Andrei Zaitin and Dima Golubov came up actually with an alternative theory, and they proposed that actually the interaction between the electrons, or the fluctuation of the electromagnetic field due to the interaction of the electrons, can lead to saturation of the phase coherence time. Okay? And then, well, since then, there's a rather heavy discussion and going on in our community. And the reason why this discussion is relatively nasty is because the problem is relatively important. If this is true, that actually the phase coherence time at zero temperature is finite, well, that has consequences to our physical understanding of what actually the ground state of a metal is. Actually, is the ground state really described by a thermal liquid? It also, well, has consequences on, well, what is our understanding of insulators, Anderson localization and scaling, of course, quantum dissipation, and of course, single electron and interacting electrons. Okay? So I will address this problem in the second part of my talk. Now I will look at this system. So I will take our electron quantum system, so our metal, and what I do, I simply change the geometry of the system and see what the phase coherence time does. So the system we'll look at is basically a quantum wire. So that's the schematic. It's a long wire, so we cannot, that's just a practical thing. We cannot make a huge long wire with a width. So this wire is about meters wide, okay? And it's several hundred micrometers long, so we cannot make a long line, so we make a meander line. But that doesn't matter because the mean part of the electron is very, very small compared to all geometric dimensions, so it diffuses along the network or along the wire, okay? So it doesn't really see the geometry, okay? So that's why we just make a meander line. So now if we change actually going from a wire to a network, actually can this affect the quantum coherence? Okay? And that's what we're going to look at in the first part of my talk. And actually this was motivated by recent calculations of these two people, Ludwig and Merlin and Texier Montambeau. So they looked at the problem, so this is what we call the Aronoff-Bohm interferometer. So this we can make out of metal. So this is just a ring with two arms, and we can inject electrons here, which then, well, this is a phase coherent object, okay? So the electron which goes from here to here doesn't lose its phase, okay? That's what we call a phase coherent object. So the electron which goes from here to here keeps its phase, okay? It's, yeah. Okay, so you can have scattering where you don't lose the phase, okay? That's an elastic scattering. When it loses its phase, it will be inelastic. So what means that from here to here, we have no inelastic scattering event, okay?
So what's the phase-breaking length in these?
So it's of the order. So in a metal, in the best metals, you will see it's about 10 micrometers, okay? So the system has to be of micrometric size, okay? And then we can ensure that the electron which goes from here to here keeps maintain its phase, okay? And this is nothing else than what you know from your optics class, the Young's double split experiment. So inject here, well, you don't use electrons, you use photons, okay? You use a laser, you shine on two slits, and you will see interference pattern on the screen, okay? Here we do exactly the same thing. We inject electrons, the electron wave function splits up in two paths, okay? Recombines here, and then it interferes, okay? But, well, we cannot look at this on a screen. What we do, we change the magnetic field because the electron couples to the vector potential, okay? And every time you change the field, it picks up a magnetic phase, and then if the phase on this path here and here is the same, if the path is exactly the same, okay, since the magnetic field is the same all over the place, so then you have a constructive interference. If the path is a bit longer, it's destructive. So if you make a trace the resistance as a function of magnetic field, you will see oscillations with a periodicity which is exactly the flux quantum, putting one flux quantum E over H in this little ring. Okay? So now this line here just shows you, now we take a system where the phase coherence is smaller than the perimeter of the ring. Okay? So then you will only get contributions of the electrons which are inside the ring. Okay? And then these people calculate the phase coherence. And then these people, they looked at the same thing, but taking a phase coherence length which is much larger than the ring. And then what you will see, actually, here you will only get contributions which are inside the ring, whereas here, actually, the electron can go, for instance, around the ring. It can go around here, but it can also come back and can go out again. And this will make a big difference. Okay? So and that's what we will look at in the first part. Okay, so the real sample actually looks like this. So this is now our pattern. So this is about here, this is about 50 micrometer long here. So the wire, the width of the wire is about 120 nanometers. The thickness about 50 nanometers, and the length of the whole wire, so this is the wire's our meander line, is about 480 micrometers. So what we do, we inject the current here, and then we recover the current here, and then we can measure, for instance, between these two probes, the voltage, okay? And we do a simple transport measurement, okay? So this is a wire, and then we go from the wire. So we do the same thing later on a network. So this is a square network. You see these little squares here. So there's a blow-up of this little spot here. And you see, so this is narrow branches of about 60 nanometers and length of 640 nanometers. And what we do these samples, we evaporate everything at the same time. So we can ensure the electronic properties of this system and this system is exactly the same. Okay? So the electric mean free path. So that's elastic mean free path. So that's the distance between each elastic scattering event. Okay? This 20 nanometers, the same here. Since the wire is very, very long, so this is the electron describes the diffusive motion to the wire. So this diffusion constant, so both networks have exactly the same electronic properties. Okay? So now what we do is, so we measure what we call quantum coherence. So now we measure the magnetoresistance. Okay, so since it's a wire, we don't get oscillations, but we get a dip in the resistance. So this is the resistance as a function of magnetic field. So when we make such a measurement, what we look at is closed loops. Actually, I should have made a little drawing. So if you have a wire like this, okay, so you measure the voltage or inject the current here. So you have an electron which diffuses through this network, but from time to time it makes little loops. Okay, it can also go like this or like that. So if a particle goes from here to here, okay, the probability that the length of the path is the same is basically zero because we average over all paths. Okay, so all these paths don't contribute to the quantum coherence. Okay, because this path and this path has a different length. You sum up over all paths, this is zero. Okay, but you can have special paths which are like this, these closed loops. So you have an electron which goes this way and the other electron which goes that way. This path is exactly the same, and as it has the same length, you will have a constructive interference here. That means the probability of finding an electron here is decreased. That means the probability of finding the electron there is decreased. Okay? And that's exactly why you find a zero field. So if we do this then as a function of magnetic field, we find here a dip in the resistance, and that's exactly the quantum correction. This is due to quantum interference loop in our system, okay? And this is what's called weak localization. So that's known since 20 years, okay? And that's a standard way of measuring the phase coherence time, and that's what we do. So we measure the resistance. So this would be the classical resistance if you crank up the field up to here. And when you go to zero field, you see this dip, which is due to this time reverse path of the electron, okay? And then so there's a theory how to fit this curve, so this black line, and simply from the fit, which is basically the height of this peak, you can extract the phase coherence time, or the phase coherence length, which is written here as a function of temperature, and that's what we get, and that's basically what the theory tells us. So at high temperatures, we have electron-proton contribution, which have this power law, and at the low temperatures, we have electron-electron interaction contribution, which is the Ultra-Arnold-Kaminsky law, which is L to the T to the minus one-third. This works very well down to about 30 millikelvin. So for the moment, I don't talk about this. I will talk about this later on, okay? This is silver. Okay? So I'll talk about this later. Okay? That's the dispute. I mean, this should go to infinity here, but it does not, it's separate. Okay? But that's not the point at the moment. So now, okay, so this works nicely for a quantum wire. So now what we do exactly the same experiment, but now on a network, okay? And we want to, in principle, since this is the same metal, the same system, we should get exactly the same phase coherence time, okay? So that's what we do. So now we take a network, and so now rather than having just a wire, we have, well, a network, a square network. Okay? So now we force our electrons on certain passes. Okay? It cannot go here, so it has to go here, and now it can make loops, or it can go here and go back. Okay? So now, what the electron can do is, the phase coherence length is very large, it can make loops in this network. So it can go once around this square, okay? So that's like this arm of both interference. And also this way. Okay. You're an experimentalist? No? Okay, so the electron actually can make loops around these squares, okay? And if the electron goes once around the loop, actually, the amplitude of this oscillation we will get in our experimental curve, actually, it's exponentially dependent on the length of the loop compared to the phase coherence length. So that's why it's written here for this. That's the first loop, 1, 2, 3, 4 times the lattice constant, okay? And for the loop, the next bigger loop where we enclose two squares is 6a over, well, 6a, because this is exactly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay? But we could also go twice around, okay? That would be the next one, so that's, if you encircle, for instance, three loops, then you have 8a, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, we'll get when we make such an experiment, because the electron can explore the entire network. Okay? So yeah, but it's for just to get the recording. That's why we need the microphone. So. Well, I put it in here, and maybe I put this a bit higher. No? Well, we'll see. Okay, so now, and I switched also. No, we're going the wrong direction. Yeah. Okay, so then we can also actually do this on a different network, and we can actually show that the electron can see on what network it travels. It can actually know on which geometry it runs around, even though it's a diffusive motion, okay? The electron bounces many, many times in such a branch before coming actually at an intersection. There's no reason why, if it's a classical system, there's no reason why the electrons should see on what network it actually travels, okay? So here the difference between this network and this network is that the first harmonic, okay, is also 4a, okay? The second one is the same, it's also 6a, but now for the third harmonic, so to encircle three of these unit cells, it's only 6, okay? So 6a, okay? And that's the difference. And you will see when we make the experiments, we can see this, okay? But I won't talk about this, but we can show this. So now we can numerically calculate the amplitudes of these oscillations, okay? So that's basically, if you go back, so we can calculate this amplitude, this exponential decay with L phi. Okay, no, sorry, that's the wrong direction. So that's here. So this is the amplitude of this oscillation as a function of L phi, or A over L phi. A is a constant, it's just a lattice constant. And you see that it exponentially decreases for the first harmonics with a slope of 4a, for the second harmonics for a slope of 6a, and then 8a. Okay, that's the square lattice. And the difference, for instance, to this other lattice, which we call the T3 lattice, it's that the first harmonics is the same here. It's with the slope of 4a, but the other two harmonics have the same slope, okay? So now what we can do, since you don't know there are certain coefficients in front of the exponential, which we don't know, so what you can do, we can just take the ratios of these amplitudes, okay? So we divide these amplitudes, and then you get the ratio. So that's the first harmonics divided by the second, so that would be this one, the first divided by the third, and so on, okay? And now this is a very, very convenient way of extracting the phase coherence length. So now we only have to determine in our measurement the ratio of this harmonic, and as soon as we have the ratio of the harmonic between, for instance, 1 and 3, we get the phase coherence length. Look, just from this graph, okay? And now we do such an experiment. So what we do is actually we make this experiments where we measure the magnetoresistance. So this is the resistance as a function of magnetic field. So now you get exactly the same curve as before. That's this weak localization curve. So this is the decrease of the resistance. But in addition, you get these oscillations because now you force the electrons on closed trajectories on these loops. Okay? So you get these oscillations. Exactly. That's what you see here. Okay? So here's everything is in there, okay? The entire harmonic contact, first, second, third, up to the ones we can see if the phase coherence length is long enough. Okay? So then what we simply do, we subtract this smooth background here, so then you get this, and then we take a Fourier transform, okay? And then you get all the harmonics. Okay? You see this, you get for the first peak, that's when the electron goes once around the little square. And that's when the electron goes twice around the square. That's when it goes three times, four times, five times, six times. In this network, actually, the phase coherence length is quite large. We can go six times around the little square, okay? So now what we can simply do, we take, this is the first harmonic, that's the second and the third. So we take the ratios, so as I showed before. So we take the ratios here, so that's just taking, we integrate this peak, okay, and this one, and we divide these two, and then we go on this graph and extract the phase coherence length, and that's what's shown here as a function of temperature. And then we do this for several square lattices, different sizes, different geometries, and everything falls on one curve, so these things do work, okay? But what is interesting is that this temperature dependence is quite different from what we got on the wire, okay? So now we can also calculate, our theoreticians can also calculate the envelope around. That's just the weak localization curve we saw before for the wire, but you add also that the electrons is on closed circles, okay? So they can calculate this analytically, and that's what you can do now, sorry. So that's this. So this is basically our curve. That's the weak localization, and on top you have these oscillations, and from this again you can extract the phase coherence length, okay? So this works very, very nicely at high temperatures, but as you go to lower temperatures, and what happens at lower temperatures, actually the phase coherence length gets much, much larger, and then suddenly this doesn't work anymore, okay? And we were quite surprised why this didn't work, but actually that's quite obvious. So now I make a summary of all this. So this is now the L5 we extract as a function of temperature for these two different systems. So one is a wire, so that's the green dots, which you saw before, and the green line is the theory what we expect for one-dimensional system, okay? So that works for the one-dimensional system, works very nicely. So now these people can also calculate this for a loop, okay? So that's actually, we were motivated by these calculations here. So the electron, when it's on a loop, when the phase coherence length is smaller than the ring, actually here, then you expect this temperature dependence. And when you have a phase coherence length which is larger than a loop, then actually you have a temperature dependence which is much weaker. And that we can understand simply by the fact that the electron here, in this case, it can escape the loop, it can go in the branches, come back, pick up a phase, or lose coherence, come back, and it will only contribute then afterwards to the loop. So you don't really see in the amplitude what the electron actually does in here. So we can understand that we come for the Arnoff-Bohm loop here, for a small L5 from this temperature dependence to this. Unfortunately, our theorists cannot calculate this for square lattice, but it goes in the right direction when you start from a one-dimensional quantum wire to a network. This should decrease because it's simply, if you have a network like this with an intersection here, okay, if the phase coherence length L5 is smaller than A, so that's shown here, if it's smaller than the lattice constant, then of course the electron sees the network just as a one-dimensional wire, okay? So that's why at high temperatures everything coincides, okay? But at low temperatures, as soon as the electron can explore now all the network, okay, then of course this fails, and the electron picks up decoherence in these branches which are outside of the wire. That's why these two are different. What is very surprising for us and what we don't understand at the moment, if you take the envelopes, you get something which is different from what you get from the higher harmonics. And that should not be the case, because that's taken from from the network. Okay, so this we don't understand why in one case we get two different values for the phase coherence length. So what I showed here is that actually L phi, the phase coherence length or the phase coherence time, is a topological quantity. Okay, it depends how the geometry of your network is.
Okay.
If I go to lower temperatures?
Yeah.
Well, we could go, but it's extremely difficult to measure because you see what we have to measure is at least two harmonics. Okay? And if you go lower in temperature in these systems, so you have to worry that you don't overheat the system. That's simply an experimental problem. So you measure resistance, so if you want to go two times lower in temperature, you have to decrease two times lower the current to not exceed EV equals KVT, okay? Well, this depends a bit on the resistance. When you do a square lattice, it's much lower resistance, okay? Because it's a two-dimensional object. And the quantum correction is delta R over R squared, okay? So the higher the resistance, the easier it is to measure, okay? But while we made some measurements at lower temperatures, the noise increases, okay? We see this peak a bit, but it just continues like this, okay? And the fact actually that that here, you see that at lower temperatures something else happens. So as soon as the L phi is much bigger than one loop of the network, then this analytical approach for L phi small doesn't work, you see here. So that's why we don't have points for the envelope at lower temperatures. So here, in principle, we have the envelope, but we have no ceiling, okay? Okay, but the point I want to make is that the electron actually is very sensitive to geometry, okay? So that's one point where how you can have decoherence in such a system, simply by the geometry. So one has to be very careful what one looks at, okay? So now, the second point, in the last part, on the second part of my talk, I look at, so now the environment here, we will look what is the influence if you put a spin, okay? And the simplest thing to put a spin is to put in a magnetic impurity, okay? So you put a magnetic impurity in a metal, and what you get is, you get what's called the Conway effect that you know from your solid state course, and that's something which is very old, okay? And the most well-known feature of the Conway effect, of course, is the resistance increase. So if you measure the resistance in a metal which has magnetic impurities, the resistance as a function of temperature, at high temperatures you have, again, the electron-phonon term, then you have a resistance minimum. If there were no magnetic impurities, this should go to zero temperature. So this should go down to here. So if you have magnetic impurity, you have this famous logarithmic increase and then a saturation at lower temperature. Okay, and this was explained in the 60s by Kondo, and this logarithmic increase, okay, due to the coupling between the magnetic impurity and the host metal, okay, via the conduction electrons. So now, actually, a long-standing problem is what is the temperature difference of the phase coherence time in such a system, okay? At that time, they looked just at the bulk material, very big metal, I mean, a huge wire. You cannot measure phase coherence in such an object because you need a system which is smaller than the phase coherence length. Okay, so this is something which is relatively young on the experimental point of view. So if you measure the phase coherence time as a function of temperature, what you expect is that at high temperatures, again, okay, you have the electron phonon interaction. So this we know now. So this is a power law here. So then when you make such an interference experiment, so what you will see actually that a spin, when an electron hits a spin, then this is an inelastic scattering, so actually the spin is flipped of the electron, but also of the magnetic impurity, and this leads to decoherence. Okay? But what happens in the system, as soon as you go to lower temperatures, the electron cloud, the conduction electron, will screen this magnetic impurity, and then actually this ground state here, this should be a non-magnetic state, actually all the electrons are able to screen perfectly the magnetic impurity spin. And then, well, this should be an object which does not decohere since it's a static impurity, okay? So then this phase coherence time should increase again. The question is, how does it increase, and does it ever go back to what we believe is the temperature dependence or the Fermi liquid prediction, okay? So, as I told you, so if you put a magnetic impurity into a metal, so you have a spin flip scattering, so electrons with a spin scatters on a magnetic impurity, which could be, for instance, iron. And then you can have, well, a scattering event which can be either elastic or inelastic, and in this case you create the electron hole pair. Okay? So now what is very nice is to do an interference experiment. If you do an interference experiment like weak localization, as I told you before, so we look at these time-reversed loops. So that's one of these time-reversed loops. So the electron bounces on many static impurities, but when it hits a magnetic impurity, of course, it will flip the spin. The other electron, which goes around the other way, it does the same, but since it goes in the opposite direction, it loses, when it comes back, actually, the interference is destructive, okay? So simply by doing an interference experiment, you're very, very sensitive to the presence of a single magnetic impurity, okay? So what we actually know from theory is that at high temperatures, so there's an old expression, so this is, you can make a perturbative calculation, and you see that the spin flip scattering time basically varies with 1 over the logarithm of T of its K, okay? And we also know at very, very low temperatures, you can treat the problem in a Fermi liquid description. This was done by Nozier, also in 74. And you get out that the inelastic, quasi-particle inelastic relaxation rate or scattering rate is T-squared dependent. So the T-squared is always the signature of Fermi liquid. Okay? So these high temperatures and low temperatures. But what happens in between, we did not know at all until very recently, and actually there's now an energy theory available which bridges the gap between the low temperature and the high temperature expression. And also what we look at actually is the ground state really a Fermi liquid? Can we actually observe this T-square dependence in the phase coherence time? Okay? So we do similar measurements. So we take a quantum wire, as you saw before, and we measure this weak localization. The only difference now, we take a wire and we put deliberately magnetic impurities. So in this case, it's a gold wire and we put magnetic iron impurities, okay? So and what we get at first glance, that looks very, very sympathetic. So here it's tau phi as a function of temperature. You have the high temperature part. This is the electron phonon, okay? Then when you come to the condor temperature, we know from old studies on resistivity. So then you have this sort of plateau. This is due to the spin flip scattering. So now we have really a strong mechanism for decoherence. So if there were no magnetic impurities, it should follow this line here, but it's well below. And then it decreases below the condor temperature. This we can also understand. But the increase here is much, much slower than what we expect from Fermi liquid. Okay? So at that time, we were quite puzzled. And what was quite funny, when we plotted this 1 over tau phi, so this is the same data here, 1 over tau phi is a function of temperature on a linear plot. This is perfectly linear, okay? It's not T squared, but it's T, okay? And that's not what is expected, but then our colleagues in Hungary, they calculated actually now the inelastic cross-section. So they just make a scattering problem and take an electron, bang it on a magnetic impurity, it shoots out, and then they calculate the inelastic scattering cross-section. Actually, that's not so simple. So what they did, they came up with a clever idea. They can calculate the elastic cross-section. And they can also calculate the total cross-section, and they get the inelastic cross-section from the difference. Okay? So now what they calculate is the inelastic scattering cross-section. So here, that's the red curve. As a function of frequency, okay, they make a zero temperature calculation for all energies. Okay? And the curve which interests us is actually this little inset here. So this red curve is the inelastic scattering cross-section as a function of temperature. So at high temperatures, they get this high temperature expression, which is the logarithm squared. At low temperatures, at very, very low temperatures, you have to go much below a tenth of TK to get the T-squared dependence of the Fermi liquid. But in between, they get a linear T-dependence. Okay? And that's exactly what we saw in our measurement. Okay? So now what we do, actually, we analyze our data with this theory. So this is the tau phi measured of our data. So here's the data of two different samples with two different magnetic impurity concentration. That's the high temperature theory, which obviously does not work at all at low temperatures. That is the theory if there were no magnetic impurities. And now we replace this high temperature theories by the energy calculations, and that works actually very, very well. Okay? So of course, the disagreements here at low temperatures, and I will come to that at the very end of my talk, if time allows. Okay? So actually, to show you how this linear regime actually fits well, that's now a linear scale, so 1 over tau phi is a function of temperature, and you see over almost one order of magnitude, so here, from here to here, it's very, very nicely described by this numerical renormalization group theory. Okay? It's the Kondo temperature and the concentration, okay? The Kondo temperature, in principle, we know, okay? And the concentration we also know, but I come back to this thing later. If you do it by implantation, so we can count one by one how many we put in, then there's no fit parameter at all, actually. Okay, but in this case, of course, we adjusted the impurity concentration since the samples were simply done by a source which contains initially magnetic impurities. It's a very good measure for the magnetic impurity concentration, because here we have ppm, so one part per million. Not a single chemical analysis can actually determine one part per million, okay? Yeah. So this is known, and it's around 0.8. Yeah, so this works, okay? So now, well, this calculation, I have to add a few comments. This is a finite energy calculation, zero temperature. What we measure is finite temperature, zero energy, because we measure it at KT. Okay, but it seems that this relation actually holds. Finite energy and zero temperature, and zero energy and finite temperature seems to be at least okay in the temperature range investigated. And also, they calculate sigma inelastic and not 1 over tau phi. Okay, but indeed, a very recent paper by our colleagues in Köln, Achim Roche and Theo Kosti. So they made now an energy calculation of real tau phi, so they calculate electron-electron interaction and disorder in their calculation. So it just came out a month ago, and they show that actually the difference between this and this are very, very small, actually on a experimentally non-detectable level. Okay. So now what we know from this analysis is that we have now a theory which satisfactorily describes the experimentally measured temperature dependence, at least down to 0.2 TK. Below, we have some deviations, and I will come back to that later on, okay? And also, there were earlier measurements, which I didn't show to you, so which actually claimed at that time that this is a non-Fermi liquid because the temperature dependence, which was very anomalous, it was not T squared, it was a very, very slow temperature dependence. But that actually, I mean, explains... It's explained now by the energy theory. You first go into a linear regime, and then you actually recover T squared only at very, very low temperatures. Okay? So, but now we have a theory, and that's important, to analyze the saturation of tau phi on very clean samples. Okay? Because these people who measure it in very clean samples and tell us that it does not saturate, or the deviation to the theory comes from a tiny amount of magnetic impurities, this we can now test, because we have a theory about tau phi for samples which contain magnetic impurities, okay? And that we will do now in the next 5 minutes. And then at the end, we will look what is actually the ground state of the system when you have magnetic impurities. Can you actually reach the Fermi liquid, the T squared regime, okay? Because for this, you have to go to very, very low temperatures, okay? So these are now the best metallic quantum wires made with the highest phase coherence length ever, okay? So this is tau phi as a function of temperature for gold wire, and here I have to apologize Richard Webb, who actually evaporated us this wire. And here we have a silver wire, which was evaporated by our colleagues in Paris in the Quantronics group, and that's the result. And so you see that in both cases, at the lowest temperatures, we have deviations to the theory, and that's actually the problem which is around. So is this saturation due to some intrinsic effect, or is it to some noise, magnetic impurities, and so on? Okay? And to show you that these data are very consistent with what was measured before by our colleagues who of the Sackley-Michigan collaboration. I superpose their data, and you see they measure this on a gold wire. They measure this on a silver wire. Of course, they don't go as low in temperature as we do. Okay? But in all cases, there's saturation, and they perfectly agree. Okay? So now the question is this deviation, can you explain this by magnetic impurities? Okay? That's what we're going to analyze now, simply by using this new energy theory, which was not available a few years ago. Okay? So, well, if you do this measurement, of course, people always ask you, can you measure to these low temperatures? Okay? In a small metallic system, okay, if you put a tiny current, you can heat your electrons. Okay? You always have to assure that EV, so the voltage across the entire samples, is smaller than kBT, that you're in thermal equilibrium. Okay? So fortunately, we have an in situ thermometer in our system. That's the electron-electron interaction contribution to the resistivity at high magnetic field. So if you apply a certain magnetic field, then you will have a... There's the electron-electron interaction contribution. Well, I won't go into detail. What one knows is that this contribution is proportional to 1 over square root of T for a one-dimensional wire, and that's actually this line. And you see this is now plotted as 1 over square root of T. People usually cover this temperature range. This is 40 millikelvin. We can go down to 10 millikelvin, you see. It follows if you apply a current, which is, of course, satisfying this EV equals KT. In this case, we overheat, and you see you heat the electrons. Okay, but this is nice. This is an in situ thermometer and tells us that our electrons are definitely cold. Okay. So now we take, for instance, first the gold wire. That's the same data as before. And now we fit. This is the theory without magnetic impurities. And now we can play. We can play with the impurity concentration and with the quantum temperature. So let's play 40 millikelvin, 0.008 ppm. So this obviously doesn't work. Now we simply lower the contour temperature to get this low temperature tail. And if you take a contour temperature which is lower than the measuring temperature, then you can always fit the data. Okay? Okay, this is very well described, but you need a contour temperature below 10 millikelvin. Okay? So now you look in all the tables what you have in your old solid state books, and you find an impurity which is manganese, which has 3 millikelvin as a contour temperature. Fine, we can explain the data, okay? But I made a little but, okay? You can also fit this with simply adding a constant, okay? And that's what Andre tells us. So he has his theory about electron-electron interactions that actually there's a finite saturation time at low temperature. So this fits equally well, okay? But this doesn't tell you what's the reason, okay? So now we do the same thing on a silver wire, okay? And there it gets more interesting because here it follows relatively well the AAK down to about 30 millikelvin, and then we see deviations. If we want to assign these deviations to magnetic impurities, then we have a hard time because we need a concentration of 0.0008 ppm. That's like every 10 micrometers of magnetic impurity. So you have to hit the magnetic impurity in your sample. And also you need a TK of 1 millikelvin, okay? So the question is this reasonable? Okay, so I won't answer this question here, but this tells you that at the moment, I mean, there's no experiment which shows agreement with the AAK theory. So all data exactly. Okay, so that was only a byproduct of our studies. Okay, so what we were really interested in is what is the ground state of this quantum system? Okay, so and as you have seen before, so this is actually quite a challenging experiment because you want to have a system where you can attain temperatures much, much lower than the contour temperature. You have to go almost to 1/100th of the contour temperature. You would like to cover 3 decades in temperature. Okay, you want to have the maximum in tau phi, you want to have the linear regime, and then the T-square regime. Okay, you need a clean system as a starting point, because if you don't have a clean system in the beginning, you will never, ever see Fermi liquid. Okay, and you have to have a very good control on magnetic impurity concentration. Okay, so now what we did, so we did some simulations with the theory and see what kind of quantum temperature you need. So these are simply simulations taking the energy theory and plugging in numbers, different numbers for the quantum temperature and for the impurity concentration. Okay, the green line would be, that's the standard theory. There were no magnetic impurities. We add magnetic impurities, of course, then we have this spin-flip scattering plateau here. And if we want to see this T-square regime that's here, so we have to go sort of, we can measure down to about 10 millikelvin, so we have to have a contour temperature of around 3 Kelvin. Okay? And the system which is we found in the literature actually is iron and silver. So this is very nice, because silver, we know we can make very, very clean wires, and the contour temperature of this is 3.5 Kelvin. Okay? So now if you add magnetic impurities, you want to be sure that every sample is the same. Okay? So what we do, we make many, many samples on one wafer. Okay? We write here our little structure. And then we come with a focused ion beam. So these are our friends in Bochum in Germany who do this. And they implant into each wire a different impurity concentration. Except one sample, of course, where we don't implant at all. Okay? And we can also make simulations where the ions go. So this is a simulation. So this is the ion concentration as a function of the depth in our material. So we have 50 nanometers of silver on a silicon oxide wafer. And you see if you inject this with 100 kilovolt acceleration voltage, then we have sort of a peak in the middle of our wire. Okay? So basically all ions sit sort of in the middle of our wire. Okay? So now, first we do standard resistivity measurement, okay? So this is the resistance as a function of temperature on such a wire, it's always the same. And we have, for instance here, two different samples with two different ion concentrations, okay? So if you do this on a pure wire, you don't see anything except the electron-electron interaction term. So what you see here is the data, and they really show these typical features of the contour system. You have the saturation at low temperatures, then this logarithmic decrease, and then the phonon term at high temperatures, and we can extract from this a contour temperature which is about 3 Kelvin, plus minus. Okay, so this contour temperature comes out if you fit simply with a spin equals 1/2 energy theory. Okay? So for the moment, don't look at the other two lines. I come back to this later on. So this is the blue line, so this is the spin 1/2 energy theory. And from this fit, so you see, it doesn't perfectly work at low temperatures. That's not surprising, but I will come to this later on. So from this, we get a contour temperature of 3 Kelvin. Okay? So now we make the tau phi measurement, and that's what we get. So this is the pure sample. That sample has about 2 ppm, 10 ppm, 25 ppm of magnetic impurities. And what you see here, so this is the clean sample, which follows sort of what we expect. That's the one with a 2 ppm concentration, 10, and like this. So you see the shoulder, what we expect from spin flip scattering, then the desaturation, and then, surprisingly, actually, again, they saturate at a value much lower than the clean sample. And what is very actually astonishing is it seems like they seem to scale with impurity concentration. Okay? So if you put now a fit of this energy theory, you see it fits quite well down to about, 300 millikelvin and below, it deviates, okay? And then here we get a contour temperature which is actually different than the contour temperature we get from the resistivity data if we take the spin 1/2 theory, okay? So now, if this is due to contour physics, everything should scale with concentration, impurity concentration, okay? If you're in the single impurity model, it doesn't matter if you have two or three if they don't talk to each other, okay? So that's what we do. And that's what we get. So we get, so this is now 1 over tau m. So this is the magnetic contribution to the defacing rate. So I go back. So here we have the phonon term. Okay. Here we have the electron term. So all these contributions add up in, I'm missing the formula. So 1 over tau phi, what we measure, is 1 over tau the electron-electron interactions plus 1 over tau the electron-phonon interactions plus 1 over what we call m, and that's the part which is due to the magnetic impurities. And what we do this, we measure, is we know, so we just subtract and get this out and plot 1 over Tm, okay? So this is the phonon term, this is the electron-electron term of the pure sample, and then we get the magnetic term, and that's shown here, okay? And we just plot 1 over tau, okay? So that's shown here. So what is very, very nice, we get a universal curve for gamma S times the impurity concentration, okay? This really tells us that this is due to the magnetic impurity, okay? But again, we get deviations from the Fermi liquid theory below 0.1 pK. Okay? So you see it's better if you make this on a log-log plot. So this is shown here. So this is basically what you get for the spin 1/2 model. And that's what we get. So there's significant deviations at lower temperatures, and we don't see this T-squared Fermi liquid temperature dependence. Okay? So this puzzled us, of course, a while, and while there's actually no reason why we should see, actually, or why this should agree with the spin 1/2 theory. Okay? If you take iron and you put this in a metal, iron, if you look in the periodic table, this is not a spin 1/2. Okay? Iron is a spin 2. Okay? If you want to screen a spin 2 with a spin 1/2, you need 4 spin 1/2 to screen it completely. Okay? So the idea we had in mind, okay, this must be an underscreened system. Okay? So then our colleagues in Köln and Jülich, they calculate actually the energy for this underscreened model, for spin 1, spin 1, 3 half, 4, 2, and 5 half. And what is very surprising, or actually it's not so surprising, but what comes out is that as soon as you have a spin which is underscreened, it's like another magnetic spin with a S minus 1/2 spin. Okay, if the S is bigger than 1/2, and the smallest spin you can have is 1, 1 minus 1/2 gives another 1/2, then of course this leads to huge deface. Okay, so here, this is the S1 curve here, and you see already for spin 1, you will get significant defacing at low temperatures. Okay, this cannot be explained by any underscreen scenario. Okay. So this is a very, very puzzling temperature dependence, which we cannot explain at the moment. What you can say is that it's due to the magnetic impurities because it scales with the impurity concentration. One possible scenario is when we implant our magnetic impurities, we accelerate the magnetic ion, we bombard really violently our metal, and this can create defects. Okay? And these defects would scale with the ion concentration. Okay? But you have to have defects which are active, so which are not static impurities, but dynamical impurities, which still are active below, 100 millikelvin. Okay. So, and that brings me to my conclusion. So I'm almost on time. So we have shown in the second part that the magnetic contribution to the defacing rate is a universal function of T over TK. Okay. And this temperature dependence is remarkably well in agreement with energy studies of S equals 1/2. Okay? And that's quite remarkable because iron is really not a spin 1/2. So what we think this must be, you must have many conducting channels where you can actually screen the magnetic impurity and this perfectly screens the spin except at the lowest temperatures, which, as I told you, we don't know at the moment. So we clearly show that with our energy calculations for higher spins, that we can rule out any underscreen scenario. Okay? So the open question we have in the system, what is actually the origin of this puzzling temperature dependence of tau phi below TK, 0.1 TK? Okay, thank you.